Oh, it's my pleasure to be talking here, especially so because we're celebrating Jack's 60th. The point is, 60 is an arbitrary number for Jack. He might not recall this, but exactly 8 years ago, I saw him here for the first time in this room. He was sitting there wearing jeans. I've never seen him in anything else but jeans, actually. Well, he doesn't seem to have aged much in those 8 years, and I hope that trend continues. Okay, well, let me start telling you about what I'm going to talk about. I apologize for not having my title up. I wasn't quite sure what I was going to talk about until very recently. So it's Teats Buildings and Applications. So what is a Teats Building? Well, you'll figure out in this 1 hour what a Teats Building is. But right now, very briefly, a Teats Building is a so it's associated to a group. Well, special kinds of groups, and they retain information about the group, and you can study these spaces and derive information about the group. But I'm interested in Teats buildings for infinite dimensional groups. So these are topological groups. So this idea really isn't very popular, as far as I see it. Quillen has studied it when he studied loop groups, and then Steve Mitchell took that idea and took it further and derived some consequences. But not much seems to have been done after that. And what I want to do today is to convince you that these objects are actually very interesting and they come up more often than you realize. And the problem is that when they do come up, they come up in a context where you don't realize them as Teats building. You realize them as something else and you forget the fact that it's a Teats building. So I want to convince you of the statement I just made by giving you an example today. So here's what I'm going to do today. So there's going to be two parts. So the first part, I'm going to just describe some examples of discrete Teats buildings, things you can identify with, things you may have seen before. And the second part is, so I'm going to describe some topological Teats buildings, and I'm going to convince you that these are actually interesting objects by attempting to generalize. Well, you'll see what I mean by attempting to. There's a theorem, but it's not geometric. So we'll at least get partway there to figure out why these are interesting objects. I'm going to generalize recent work of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann for loop groups to a general class of groups that include some other infinite dimensional groups known as hyperbolic Kac-Moody groups. So that's the plan. Okay, I'll leave that over here and move on to the next one. Okay, so let's begin with Coxeter groups. I'm going to define Coxeter groups. So I'm going to define a small class of Coxeter groups called crystallographic. My apologies. Maybe I should just get rid of one of these. Is that okay with people if I just use one transparency? So I'm going to define a special class of Coxeter groups called crystallographic Coxeter groups, and they come associated to a matrix called a Cartan matrix, a generalized Cartan matrix. And what's the generalized Cartan matrix? It's an n by n integral matrix. It satisfies these three properties. The diagonal entries are true. Off-diagonal entries are not positive. And if they're zero, they're zero in pairs. Okay, so associated to something like this, you can define a Coxeter group. A Coxeter group is a group that's given by this presentation. It's generated by these elements Ri, I going from 1 through n, n being the size of your matrix. And then it satisfies some relations, and those relations are given by this list over here. So if the product of the pairwise off-diagonal entries is among this list, then Mij are these numbers up there, and you create this group. So what you could do with a group like this is create subgroups of this group coming from subsets of this n element set from corresponding to those n reflections, and those are called parabolic subgroups or special subgroups depending on who you talk to. So those are what I'm going to call W sub I, and I will correspond to subsets of the n element set. Okay, all right. So that's what I mean by a Coxeter group. Sure. I'll leave it on the other one. The whole thing? Okay. That was actually a good idea to leave that out. You might think that this group WA is infinite if those MIJs are infinite, but that's not entirely correct. So here's an example of a Coxeter group that may be infinite, but those MIJs are all finite. And this actually corresponds to a loop group, loops on SU3. We'll worry about that later, what that means. But if you know what an affine vial group is, that's what this is, an example of an affine vial group. And it's a semidirect product of the symmetric group acting on a lattice of rank 2. So it's certainly not finite. But its Cartan matrix here tells you that all those MIJs that you use to construct your Coxeter group are all finite numbers. But somehow you get an infinite group out of it, even though the relations come out of finite, by putting in finite entries. So I'm going to assume the following from now on. So I'm going to assume that my vial group is infinite, because those are the cases that I'm interested in. And I'm going to assume that A is indecomposable. That is to say, I don't want to worry about Cartan matrices that are sort of block Cartan matrices. So it's a trivial case. You might as well study each block separately. So I'm going to assume it's indecomposable. And here's the next assumption, which is crucial, is that each W sub I is finite the moment you work with proper subgroups of the n-element set. And you'll see why that condition is crucial. So these guys, Coxeter groups that satisfy these two criteria fall into two types. They're the affine type and the hyperbolic type. The affine types are the ones that correspond to affine Coxeter groups, affine vial groups, and they're associated to loop groups. And then there's this hyperbolic type, which has not really been studied very much. I mean, it's sparsely been studied. If you look in the literature, you'll notice various people have sort of studied hyperbolic type Gasmuthi groups. But it's certainly not as extensive as the affine types. And what's a hyperbolic type Gasmuthi? I'm sorry, I keep saying Gasmuthi group. I don't want to get there so quickly. I meant hyperbolic type Cartan matrix. It's one that has a signature n minus 1, 1. So if you look at that Cartan matrix, it'll have signature n minus 1, 1. Affine types actually positive semi-definite. So it has one eigenvalue 0, and it's positive definite on the complement of that set. And these hyperbolic types, they're very interesting. In rank 2, that is to say when A has size 2, there's an infinite family of those. So we know that affine types, actually in every rank, there's finitely many of them. But the hyperbolic types, they sort of expand in the other direction. So a given rank 2, there's infinitely many of them. And then if you go beyond 2, you can easily see from the conditions that I've put up, there has to be finitely many in each rank. Because these, if you look at the MIJs, the conditions on MIJ, there has to be finitely many of them in each rank. And in fact, there's finitely many of them, period. They go up to rank 10. Beyond that, you can't have any more. So this is a classification of hyperbolic type Cartan matrices. If you look at Humphreys' book, for example, it'll classify these Coxeter groups. There's a little bit of a subtlety. There may be more than one Cartan matrix that gives you the same MIJs. It's easy to see. And so it's possible that you may get more than one Cartan matrix giving you the same Coxeter group, which is of hyperbolic type. But then there's only finitely many such Cartan matrices. You sit down and classify them. So there's finitely many such examples beyond rank 2. But there's like about 20 to 30 of them. I don't know exact numbers. But it's not like huge. It's not beyond 100. Okay. All right. Okay, so there's a lot of geometry in these guys. So let's start talking about the geometry. Before that, I want to talk about the Tietz building. So I'm going to define this poset of proper subsets of the n-element set, including the empty set. And the Tietz building for a Coxeter group with that Cartan matrix is this homotopy colimit. And I realize some people might not be familiar with a homotopy colimit. So under the assumptions we're making, it's really this object. I'm taking W, crossing it with the n-1 simplex, and I'm thinking the n-1 simplex is a simplex with walls that are indexed on the proper subset of the n-element set, and the interior being indexed on the empty set. So the walls correspond to subsets. It's very easy to see the identification. Codimension 1 walls correspond to subsets of cardinality 1, and so on and so forth. And the identification is that if you're going to identify pairs, where the simplex coordinate needs to be the same, and it lies on the interior of the ith face, and then the two group coordinates have to lie in the same WI coset. So it's an identification of that space, and you can see that as a homotopy colimit. So thinking of it this way has topological ramifications. Thinking of it this way, so you can actually picture this object. So let me give you an example. So rank 2, I said that there was an infinite family of hyperbolic types Cartan matrices, and these are the ones. It's a two-parameter family where the product of those two numbers, A and B, have to be bigger than 4. And here's an example of an affine one that corresponds to loops on SU2. In rank 3, here's an example, the one I just gave earlier, of an affine type. And here's one that's not affine. Okay, it can't be written as the vowel group of a loop group. Okay. All right. So what I'm going to do next is talk about the geometry. So the reason I made transparencies is so I could draw pretty pictures ahead of time. So let's talk about geometric realization here. So given the data that I've given, you can think of these Coxeter groups as reflection groups in a certain vector space, which I'm going to call dual of T. The reason for calling it the dual of T as opposed to T is because I'm going to use that later on as a dual of the Lie algebra of a certain torus. So I might as well set the notation here. Call it the dual of T. And Ri is going to be a reflection about a wall, which is set by a linear equation, Hi equals 0. And Hi is the elements in the dual of dual, so it's elements in T. I apologize for this, but it's going to make my life much simpler later on. Okay, so the fundamental vowel chamber in this vector space is going to be the subset of this vector space where all those relations are bigger than or equal to 0. So it's a cone in this subset. Okay, I'll draw pictures in a second. So that's called the fundamental vowel chamber. And the teeth cone is the W, the vowel translate of the fundamental vowel chamber. It's just a union. So I realize I might be insulting the intelligence of various people in this audience, but I just want to set notation here so that we're all together as I move on. So it's this cone inside the... I'm sorry. So the fundamental vowel chamber is a cone inside this vector space, and the teeth cone happens to be a cone, incidentally. It's the W translate of the fundamental vowel chamber. So there's some properties about Y, which is the teeth cone. The fundamental vowel chamber happens to be the fundamental domain for the W action on Y. W acts on Y almost by definition. And the teeth building, which is that homotopy collimate I just defined, is a deformation retract of the interior of Y. And you'll see in 1 second why that is the case. So here's my affine example. So remember this matrix, this rank 2 matrix is affine. It corresponded to loops on SU2. And my T star is two-dimensional. It's a two-dimensional vector space. And R1 and R2 are reflections about this hyperplane and this hyperplane. So the vial chamber is the one that I've shaded there. And I'm going to take W translates of it. And you can see the way I've drawn is that these guys keep getting thinner and thinner, and the span of the W translate is an upper half plane of this two-dimensional vector space. And you could think of it as an upper half plane by throwing in an axis, which I called tau, and I'm calling that level. Okay, so if you're familiar with some geometry of loop spaces, you'll see that that level is exactly the level when we talk about the center. So you're thinking of this vector space of characters, and you're thinking of tau as the level of those characters. But that's not really so important. There's a distinguished, the point to remember is that there's a distinguished axis called level in the teeth cone. The teeth cone here is the upper half plane. It does not include the axes down here, but it does include the origin. So when I exclude the origin, there's a natural deformation retract of that into this horizontal line, which happens to be an affine line, which is the teeth building. So that's an example of a teeth building sitting inside T star for this affine Cartan matrix. So let me give you an example of something that's not affine and what happens there. So here's an example that's not affine. In fact, these are the other examples in rank 2. So the vowel group you notice is exactly the same thing. It's the infinite dihedral group. It's generated by two reflections because A and B, their product is bigger than 4, so Mij is infinite. So it doesn't matter if you worked with the affine guy or the hyperbolic guy. The vowel group's exactly the same. But the presentation is going to be, the presentation of the vowel group is exactly the same. But I'm realizing the teeth building here as this little hyperbola in red that I've drawn. The fundamental chamber here sort of looks like the same thing before, but the teeth cone here is actually an honest cone. It's not the upper half plane. So you can't talk about a linear relation, the level. There is no concept of a level. That's one thing to bear in mind here, that in hyperbolic cases, you can't stratify your characters by something called the level. So there isn't anything like the level here. But you do have a cone, the teeth cone. It does not contain these two lines here, the boundary of the cone, does contain zero. So the interior is going to be a deformation retract of this hyperbola. Now you want to think of this hyperbola appearing as the teeth building very simply as this. I'm thinking, so remember I described the teeth building as W times this simplex with some relations. Here's how you think of it. You think of this as a simplex, this horizontal line I've drawn here. W is just taking that line and throwing it a copy of it in every single translate of the fundamental chamber. And then there are some identifications in the boundary, and those are the identifications I put up. So when you throw in those identifications, you actually indeed get this hyperbola here. Okay, so that's an example of a hyperbolic Cartan matrix and the teeth cone for a situation like that. Now you could start thinking what might happen in higher rank cases. Higher rank cases, you really want to take this picture and sort of spin it around. So your teeth cone will really honestly be a cone. Its boundary won't be included. There will be this little chamber inside it, inside the interior of the cone, where you'll have it'll be like the simplex, a cone on a simplex, and then you're taking translates off it. So if you've seen this picture, this alcove picture, this affine alcove picture, in when you study representations of semi-simple Lie groups, what that is, it's the slice of that cone. So if you slice that cone, what you'll get is a picture of those alcoves, one on top of the other. It's the fundamental domain is really a cone on that simplex, the vial alcove, known as the vial alcove. So please stop me if you have questions at any point. Sure. Absolutely. Right. That's because you can't write it as a linear equation, the teeth cone. It's not a linear equation. It's sort of given by two linear equations being positive. In the loop group case, why, you're asking me? Well, you could work. Why is there? Well, I mean, the only answer I can really give is that there is a center in that case. And somehow the center, the vial group does not touch the center, because you could think of it as conjugation by the normalizer. So the center remains fixed. So the levels that correspond to the center won't be touched by the vial group. So whatever the teeth cone is, it's going to be stratified by this parameter, the center. In hyperbolic cases, the center is discrete. So you can't have a level. The hyperbolic, it's very easy to calculate the cardinality of the center of something like this. It's just the determinant of the Cartan matrix. You look at that case, 2 minus 2 minus 2, 2, the determinant is 0. That corresponds to the fact that actually the center is not discrete. In these cases, the center is always discrete. Okay, all right. So I have a Cartan matrix, a generalized Cartan matrix, and it gives me W, this presentation for the vial group. But what it does, it also gives me an extension. It gives me an extension of W by T. So the data for this extension is all inside this Cartan matrix, and I'm going to call this extension N of T because it happens to be the normalizer of a torus somewhere, and where it will be, I'll tell you in a little bit. But right now, there's just an extension of the vial group by the torus, and that's exactly the torus whose Lie algebra is script T and whose dual is T star. So N of T now acts on the teeth building. Remember, teeth building was this homotopy colimit, which is what I've been calling X. It clearly acts on it because I've written it as a homotopy colimit of homogeneous sets. So it has a left action on that building X, and that action is proper. That is to say, all the isotropy groups are finite. If you're looking at the NT action, they're all compact because the torus fixes all of T. If you think about it, the torus actually acts on X via the projection onto W. So the torus always fixes every point. And the isotropy groups from the construction of the teeth building were W mod WIs. And remember, one of the conditions was those WIs were finite for every proper subset of my poset. So if you work that out, what that's saying is the isotropy groups are all compact. So this is a proper action of NFT. NFT is not a compact Lie group. It's locally compact. But W need not be finite. In fact, I'm assuming W is infinite. But the action, of course, is proper. So you have an action of this NFT on X that's proper. In fact, so here's a little note for topologists out there. So this X actually happens to be the classifying space of proper actions for NFT. And what that means is, so this concept of a classifying space for proper actions is unique up to homotopy, up to equivariant homotopy. And what that is, so here's what you mean by a classifying space for proper actions. It's a space, e.g., G is a group, space e.g. is said to be a classifying space for proper actions. If it has fixed points only if H is a compact subgroup of G, and in which case those are contractible. Okay? So this happens to be a property that these Tietz buildings have, thinking of a group as N of T. So they're up to homotopy, there's really that. The Tietz building is a very canonical object up to homotopy. Homotopy theorists know how to deal with objects like this. So here's the first step. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to reproduce, essentially, the paper of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann shamelessly. I'll follow the same route. I'll show you how their proofs go through in the hyperbolic case. So the first step would be to calculate the NT equivariant K theory of X. Now, NT is locally compact and acting properly on X, so this K theory can be defined. In general, you can't talk about K-theory with respect to a non-compact group acting on a space. But if you have a non-compact group but acting properly on a space, you can locally compact group acting properly on a space, you can talk about K-theory. So you can define this K-theory. It has the properties you'd expect. Now notice that the torus T acted trivially on my space X. But you're not allowed to say that the equivariant K-theory NT equivariant K theory of X is just the W equivariant K theory of X tensored with the group ring of T. And the reason for that is very simple. The extension the extension is not trivial. The extension from the T extension of the Weyl group is not a trivial extension. So even though T acts trivially on the space, the K theory is not just it's not just a tensor product like that. But here's a cool idea I noticed in their paper. And the way to think about it is that you think of a space. You think of a W space as the characters times X. So now the characters, the Weyl group acts on the space diagonally, and it's not hard to see that what this really is, it's this. And it's the NT equivariant K theory of X is the W equivariant K theory of this product with compact supports, and compact supports are to be thought of as in the quotient. So there's compact sets of quotient spaces. So you want to think of it's compactly supported K-theory, but on the quotient. So you don't want to take too many orbits at the same time. So it's the right notion of compactly supported K-theory when I'm thinking of this product space with a W action. Okay? So that's the right equality, that the K-theory of X, the NT equivariant K-theory of X, is really the W equivariant K-theory of this product. Now, if W acted trivially on the characters, this would be really this. So you see that it's really a sort of a natural way to think about it. So here's what we want to do. Okay, so these characters have two very natural W invariant subsets. The first one is those characters that lie in the interior of the Tietz cone. Remember what our Tietz cone was in the affine case. It was the upper half plane, right? So I'm talking of characters that have positive level. Those are the characters I'm talking about in the affine case. So that's a W invariant subset. There is no notion of level in the hyperbolic case, so this is really the right notion of level, all the level, positive levels put together. And there's a regular part in there, and that's the one that does not hit any of the walls in my Tietz cone. Remember, the Tietz cone was the translate, the W translate of my fundamental chamber. So the fundamental chamber had walls, so the Tietz cone has a bunch of walls sitting in there. And I'm looking at those characters that don't hit any of the walls. So that's the regular part, and that's preserved under W because that's the way W acts. It reflects around the walls. Okay, so I'm going to define two sum ends of natural sum ends of this NP equivariant K theory. It's the positive sum end, where I'm throwing in RT plus here, and then there's a positive regular sum end, that's this. So a little characterization of the interior of the Tietz cone. This, notice here, is the interior of the Tietz cone I'm putting here. I'm not allowing zero to be part of one of my characters here. The interior of the Tietz cone has the special property that if you look at the isotropy of the W action on it, it's finite. That's a characterization of the interior of the Tietz cone. Okay? That's exactly those characters that have finite bioisotropy. Okay, so the first goal is to calculate NT plus and NT plus regular. The thing is, we don't really understand the W action outside the Tietz cone. But we don't really care because the Tietz cone is invariant under W, so might as well restrict our attention to this sum end of K-theory. Outside of the Tietz cone, the W action could be quite strange. Like, for example, in the affine case, what's outside the Tietz cone is just one line. If you remember the rank 2 affine case, there was the upper half plane, and then there is also the lower half plane that corresponds to negative energy representations. It's not important. But the point is, those are the two. There's one, and then, of course, there's the other, mirror image of it on the other side, which really behaves the same way. It's like it's the copy of the first guy. But what's left over, we don't really understand how W acts on it in general. In the affine case, it's just a line. What's left over is really just a line. And the W isotropy there is this lattice, the lattice Z2 that I was talking about. There's infinite isotropy on that little line. So it's not a good thing to look at. Okay, so here's some facts. I know W acts freely on the regular set, and the reason it acts freely on the regular set is because the fundamental chamber was the fundamental domain for the W action. Okay, and the other thing is that the compactification of X is known to be an n-1 sphere. It's really a hyperbolic plane. If you see these examples, rank 2 examples I gave you, it was like a hyperbola. So the affine case, it's a real line. It's Euclidean space. In the hyperbolic case, it's a hyperbolic plane. So it's the compactification is n-1 sphere. So here's an easy consequence of that. So the regular, positive regular K-theory, NT equivariant K-theory, which is the same thing as the positive regular W equivariant K-theory when I throw in these characters, it's just a shifted copy. That's because the compactification of X is a sphere, and remember, working with compactly supported K-theory here. It's just a shifted copy of the orbits of W inside these regular ones. So those are those characters that line the interior of the fundamental vial chamber, right? Because the regular ones were exactly translates of those in the fundamental vial chamber, not hitting any of the walls. So the orbit is exactly those things that line the fundamental vial chamber. I'm going to write it like that. There's a shift here. There's an n-1 shift here. That comes from the fact that the compactification X was a sphere. Okay, so I'm going to write it like this, because W acts freely on this, these two are really the same. Okay, I could see this actually, for those of you who like to see it topologically, not geometrically like this, you can think of it as a Bousfield-Kahn spectral sequence. Remember, X was this homotopy colimit of W mod WI. So you can calculate its K-theory just using a spectral sequence, the Bousfield-Kahn spectral sequence for those orbits. And the E2 term is these limit these inverse limit higher derived functors of inverse limit, and that's going to converge to what I want. And it's very easy to check these inverse limits are really calculating the X groups of W with coefficients in the group ring of W, which is not an injective object if W is infinite. In fact, what it is, it's this. Those higher derived functors of inverse limit in dimension n-1 is what I really want, and in other guys it's zero. For other I it's zero. So in particular the spectral sequence collapses and it just gives you a shifted copy of what you want. So this spectral sequence is very different from this argument, because in this argument I integrated over X. Here I'm expanding along X. So it's like I'm doing the argument in two different directions. Okay? So they're giving me the same answer, which is always a good thing. Okay. All right. So here's a remark, which is most likely true. I haven't gone through the details. And here's a remark that, remember, what I did in the last slide was the regular part. I'm claiming that the whole, the positive K-theory, anti-Ekman K theory of X is really a shifted copy of the W Ekman K theory of R of T. Now, this is not the same thing as Z tensored over the group ring with R of T, because you may have isotropy along the walls. So this object is mysterious in itself. Okay, I'm going to leave it like that. But the point I'm trying to make here is that this guy is a shifted copy of this guy, and that simply follows from the following argument here. I'm going to identify X with this hyperbolic space. W is going to act by isometries. And now here's the part that I haven't gone through the details, so I leave this as sort of like a side remark, that it's going to support the K-theory orientations. It's going to support a Clifford bundle that's invariant under W, so a W-invariant orientation. And then, according to that, I can just simply integrate along this projection. So this projection, if you integrate, remember we're working with compact support, so I can integrate over X to get the isomorphism I want. This argument, by the way, it's not mine. Most of these arguments are very much things that I derived from Hopkins, Frieden, Hellman's paper, which has some pretty ingenious arguments, I must say. So let's now go to the second part, which is work of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann. So now I'm going to work with something that's not even locally compact, a group that's not locally compact. So I wanted to define K-theory of... So previously we were interested in NT-Ekman K-theories of this proper action on the Tietz building. So NT was a locally compact group. Things were nice. We knew what that K-theory was. So now I'm going to end up working with a non-compact group. It's going to be an infinite-dimensional group, not locally compact in any way. It's going to act on a space A properly, and properly I mean all the isotropy groups are going to be compact Lie groups. So this K-theory, the first time I saw it, is in the appendix in the work of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann. And let me give you a brief construction on how they define this. So what they do is, I'm ignoring a lot of subtleties and details here. The way they define this is basically by gluing. So like I said, the action of G on A is proper in the sense the isotropy is compact Lie at various points. So what you essentially do is glue together equivariant K-theories over this space A, equivariant with respect to the isotropy groups. And they, of course, do it in much more generality. They use words like stack, which I don't want to use here, but I'm going to work with spaces here. So the way they do it is they construct a universal bundle, universal in a certain sense, on a Hilbert bundle, which has which is G invariant. And what they do then is to construct this bundle of fiberwise Fredholm operators on it. Now there's already lots of subtleties over here, and I don't want to address them. But everything, when all the dust settles, you have this fiberwise Fredholm bundle of fiberwise Fredholm operators, and for that you can define a spectrum, the way you define a K-theory spectrum. Just do it fiberwise, and then you define the equivariant K-theory groups. Equivariant K-theory groups of A is going to be just the homotopy of the space of equivariant sections. Okay? This is how you define it. So that's how they're doing it. And the way you construct this bundle, which, by the way, is not trivial. If G was a compact Lie group, you know that the unitary transformation of a Hilbert space is trivial. So you can use that to show that this bundle itself has to be trivial. But if G is not a compact Lie group, then this bundle is non-trivial. So you're basically locally trivial, yes. So you're gluing together locally trivial K-theories. You're gluing together usual equivariant K-theories into this global object, which is, as far as I know, the first time I saw something like this. Okay. So our goal, of course, will be to calculate something like that. So I must mention, of course, that the work of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann is calculating the twisted equivariant G equivariant K theory of G acting on itself. How is that related to something like this? Well, it's not hard to see that what you will get if you sum up over all levels. Now, twisting comes with a level. Remember that level was that specific direction in the Tietz cone that corresponded to the center, and that stratified my characters. Now, if I add up over all of them, basically I'm working over the whole Tietz cone, which is the right context in this setting. So I'm working over the Tietz cone. If I sum over all characters, I'm getting this sum of all twisted equivariant K-theories of G acting on itself, the way Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann talk about it. And it's not hard to see that is the same thing as G now being the loop group, not the compact Lie group, acting on this affine space, a huge contractible affine space. they'll give you the same answer. And that answer is what I'm after in the general case. So let me introduce what the analog of loop groups is. So here's a very, very brief introduction to Kac-Moody groups. So remember, we started off with a generalized Cartan matrix A. Now, given this data, there is an infinite dimensional topological group that comes about. If A was of affine type, this group is a central extension of the loop group, of a compact Lie group. Okay? So for those of you who are not familiar with this kind of mathematics, what's important here is that I get an infinite dimensional group GA out of my data of A. Now, that GA will have a maximal torus, maximal in the sense it's the maximal abelian connected subgroup inside my group GA. And it has a normalizer, which is what I call N of T. And I've set up my terminology so that N of T is what I've been working with so far. And for every subset inside this poset of proper subsets of the N element set, I'm going to get this Levy factor, this subgroup that I call HI, which actually happens to be a compact Lie group. So this is under the assumption that all WIs are finite for proper subsets of the N element set. So this HI I get, it's a maximal rank compact subgroup of this group G, and its Weyl group is W sub I. So what I'm doing is basically I'm working with the topological analog of everything I've been doing so far. Okay? So here's the topological Tietz building. Okay, so that's the thing that I've been after all this time. I'm going to call it A, and that's the homotopy colimit of G mod H I as I ranges over the N element set. So, and its description, I should say, is identical to, so you can think of this as W times, I'm sorry, G mod T times the simplex, N minus 1 simplex, mod sum relations. Okay, so now W is being replaced by this homogeneous space G mod T times the N minus 1 simplex, and basically the same relations on the boundary, except you're replacing WI by HI. Okay, so... So the first remark is that A is a model for E sub G. That is to say, it's this universal classifying space for proper actions of this huge topological group with compact isotropy. So it's a space that people would be interested in looking at, and it's not totally it makes sense to talk about its K-theory, which is what we're going to do. But let me just finish my remarks here. So there's another way of identifying this A. It may be thought of as the G orbit of my Tietz cone in now the whole Lie algebra of G. Previously we were working with the Lie dual of the Lie algebra of the torus. Now I'm going to work with the Lie algebra of the whole group, and I'm going to take the G orbit of my Tietz cone or my fundamental Weyl chamber. Whichever one you want, it'll have the same orbit. And that's what A is. And A is related to the previous X that I was talking about, the Tietz building, as the fixed points. Now, the torus will act on A, and if you take the torus fixed points, you'll get your usual skinny building. Think of X as sort of like the skeleton of this huge guy. Okay, so they're related by fixed points. So here's what I was just mentioning. So if you have a generalized Cartan matrix, which is affine, corresponding to the loop group L of K, or I should say central extension, then the space A is a space of connections. It's the affine space of connections on this trivial bundle. So K is a compact Lie group. Its loop group is an example of one of these topological groups that appear as Kac-Moody groups for an affine Cartan matrix. And in that case, the space A can be identified with connections on this trivial bundle. So it's a trivial K bundle over the circle. You look at the affine space of connections on it, and then that space, the affine space of connections, is homeomorphic to my topological Tietz building A, which I just constructed, respecting all possible structure you might want to consider. It's homeomorphic, equivariantly, etc., etc. The last remark is that I could have considered not just these hyperbolic Cartan matrices. I could have considered any Cartan matrix, not the ones that satisfied the property that proper subsets gave you finite Weyl groups. In that case, everything I said goes through. Just that, and I've used words like stack here because I didn't know how to get around it. This will not be a smooth stack, if you know what that means. The smoothness condition is exactly the condition you need for these proper Weyl groups to be finite. Okay? And that really increases your class, right? It gives you an extra family in dimension 2, and it gives you these sporadic ones in higher dimension. So there may be a way of getting around smoothness here, but I haven't really thought through that. Okay. So here's the plan, right? I want to study G equivariant K theory of A. Remember, G is this infinite dimensional group now corresponding to a hyperbolic or affine Cartan matrix. And I'm going to study this, and this defined as in Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann. So as proceed as they do, there's this, remember X was the T fixed points of my space A. So I have a natural action map of the Borel construction of G over NT with X into A. Just take the product. And this is a G equivariant map almost by construction. So this gives you two maps in this K theory. I'm assuming smoothness because that's one of the conditions that this hyperbolic thing forces on me. So I have a Giesen map and I have a pullback map. And it goes from the K theory of A to the K theory of this space, which it's easy to see from almost by construction. And what you would really want this condition to hold in any suitable K theory that you construct, that the moment you make construction like this, you really ought to get equivariant K theory of N. So you have a map from this to this, the pullback map, and then you have this push-forward map. Okay, and here's the claim of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann, the affine setting. What they show is that this is a retraction. So the composite is an isomorphism. And this, they work locally. You could just work locally. Remember, this A was built out of these HIs. Locally, it was basically just compact Lie groups. So you might as well work locally. And as you work locally, you can work through and see that this is a retraction for each of them. Another way to write this down is to set up a Bausch-Hilkan spectral sequence for both sides, for this guy and this guy, and check that it's an isomorphism on the E2 term. That's another way of checking it. Okay? So, but here's a geometric way of checking it, is that you work locally and you see that this is a retraction, and so globally it has to be a retraction. Okay? So that's one way of showing that this composite is a retraction. So what do you get? You get that this equivariant K theory I'm interested in is splitting out of the N equivariant K theory of X. Now what I can do, no, I'm not assuming positivity or regularity here. This is just the K theory. It's splitting out of this K theory. So I'm going to define the positive part of this as the corresponding positive part. So here's my definition of positive K theory, G equivariant K theory of A. It's just the piece of this guy sitting inside the positive ones over here. Remember, the point I was trying to make all this time is that the positive part is exactly the positive energy representation. I can't take a level at a time, but I can add them all up. And what I'm doing is I'm going all over the Tietz cone. So that's exactly the right object to consider. Outside of the Tietz cone, I'm not very happy because isotropy starts getting infinite. And you know what happens outside the Tietz cone is you can calculate this K theory, but this shift that you're interested in N minus 1, really won't be at N minus 1. It'll shift down. It'll shift to 0. So the spectral sequence I'm interested in that's collapsing at the top column won't be collapsing at the top column. It'll collapse at a different column. And things start getting messy because you don't want to then worry about how they interrelate with each other. So might as well just work with this sum end where everything works well. And that's that positive sum end. And here's the main theorem, really makes everything work. It's that this image here is this regular part. And remember what the regular part was, right? This was isomorphic to Z with these characters that lay inside the interior of the fundamental vial chamber. So you had a picture like this, and these were the characters that sat inside that did not touch the walls of the fundamental vial chamber. So the proof is actually not so hard. It's the following. I'm going to show that my push forward kills regular classes. Okay. Remember there was this push forward that went from the NT equivariant K theory of X to the G equivariant K theory of A, and that was a retraction map, and I want to show that it kills all the non-regular characters. Okay. So it's just a diagram chase here. So I'm going to do this push forward. That was our locally, my push forward looks like this, if you remember. So I'm going to include the zero inside T star. So basically I'm pushing forward along the origin over here. All right, now G is just pushing forward along. So now if I have a non-regular element in this K theory, any non-regular element at this point over here can be induced up from one of the walls. That's because those are the characters that hit any of the walls. So those non-regular elements are induced up from the walls of T-star. So things inside the non-regular elements inside the NI equa and K theory of a point are induced up from the walls inside that corresponding teeth cone. Now, any such non-regular element, when you push it forward over here and then further on into A, will factor through the... Right. So it's induced up from the wall. So let U be some wall inside the interior of the teeth cone. And you consider something like this. This non-regular elements here are spanned by elements that are induced up from the walls. And the walls are inside the interior of the teeth cone. So now when you take something from these walls and you push it all the way down to A, it's going to factor through the compact group corresponding to that wall. And that compact group is the group that fixes that wall. Its while group being W sub I, intersection with the while group that fixes, intersection with the part that fixes that wall. But there's a compact part to it. That's a semi-simple times some abelian factor. So it's a reductive subgroup inside my Kac-Moody group, inside my hyperbolic Kac-Moody group, of a compact Lie group, because almost by construction it's compact. Remember, the interior walls had compact isotropy. So it factors through this guy. And now here's something that one needs to check. It took me a little bit to check, is that if you push forward from here to here, remember we're going all the way inside the K-theory of A, and it factors through this guy. So when you're pushing forward from a wall into the K-theory of A, it'll factor through the K-theory of the compact group that fixes a wall. And over there already, those non-regular elements become zero. So the moment you're pushing forward from the wall into the compact Lie group that corresponds to that situation, you'll get zero. So when you go all the way in, you'll get zero. So that's how you show the non-regular elements map to zero. And a matter of, when you consider regular elements, they're supported away from walls. So there you can actually see that it's an isomorphism on the nose. So what you've shown is non-regular elements go to zero, and on regular elements, that map is an isomorphism. So what you've shown is that the kernel is exactly non-regular elements. So the kernel of the push-forward map from here to here is all from here all the way down to kg of A. This guy has non-regular elements as kernel, and now you can work over all these guys. There's elements are supported over a finite number of orbits. That follows from a spectral sequence. The Bosfield-Kahn spectral sequence, for example, says anything can be written as a sum of things supported over a finite number of orbits. So I might as well work with an orbit at a time and show that non-regular elements from here all the way down here go to zero. And so the kernel of the push-forward map is exactly non-regular elements. So we've established this theorem. Of course, what's the point? Right? And the point here is that I can abstractly identify. So I've figured out that this guy is a shifted copy of this guy. Remember, because this was all the regular part of NT, equivariant K theory. We just established that here. We established that this guy was this guy, but this guy we noticed was just shifted copy of all the characters that lay inside the vial chamber. And so what we've done is essentially established that the positive part of this K theory is really these characters, shifted. Now there is an abstract identification between characters that lie inside this vial chamber and what are called integrable representation of my Kac-Moody group. What are integrable representations? If you know what Kac-Moody Lie algebras are, you don't have to worry about Kac-Moody groups. If you know what Kac-Moody Lie algebras are, there's a very distinguished class of representations called integrable representations. Well, almost by definition, those are the ones that integrate to the Kac-Moody groups I'm going to assume some mild smoothness conditions. But there's a very distinguished class of representations called integrable representations. And they're exactly, in the loop group case, in the affine case, they're exactly these positive energy representations. So that's the class that corresponds to the integral representation in the hyperbolic case, or in general Kac-Moody case. And they are indexed by elements in the interior of my vial chamber. And that indexing corresponds to highest weight or lowest weight, depending which you prefer. So given a character there, there's a unique representation, irreducible representation, that has highest weight over there, sitting in there, in that vial chamber. So there's an abstract identification between the integrable representations of G and this set of characters inside the carton, inside the vial chamber. So okay, so that was the main theorem. So here's the point here. I'm going to end with this remark and then make some more remarks in the 5 minutes I have. So in the affine case, a really pretty part of the paper of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann is a geometric description of this isomorphism. And the way they do it is as follows. What they do is they endow A, this space of affine connections, which is what the topological Tietz building is in the case of loop groups. They give it a Clifford module. Okay, so they give it a structure for they give it a K-theory orientation in some appropriate sense. It's an infinite dimensional module, and you're taking it's an infinite dimensional Lie algebra. It's just a Lie algebra of A, and then you take a Clifford module on that, and that is endowed with so and that has W action. It has an action of the loop group sitting on it. So it's this Lie algebra that it's this Clifford module for this Lie algebra that has action of the loop group on it. Now, on this guy, they give a family of operators, Dirac operators. Now, this family is not constant. This Clifford module is constant, but this family varies over the space, affine space A. So these are Dirac, honest Dirac operators on this family, and so each Dirac operator at a point corresponds to a Fredholm operator on that Dirac bundle at that point. So what you get is naturally it'll give you an element in this equivariant K-theory, because for every point, you have this Dirac operator, and you can think of that Dirac operator as a Fredholm as an element in this Fredholm, as a section of this Fredholm bundle, as you vary over your affine space. So it gives you an element in this K-theory as they've constructed it. And now you can always twist this Dirac operator by an integrable representation to get another Dirac operator. So it's essentially what you're doing is you're doing parameterized Palm isomorphism. That's pretty much what you're doing. So what you've shown, what they show is that there's this isomorphism here to here is by taking V and twisting it with this parameterized Dirac operator over here. So it gives you this element in K-theory, a section of this Fredholm bundle. Remember, as we constructed it as the homotopia section. So it gives you an element here, and that's how they establish this isomorphism. So our problem, of course, is that I don't know so far. I mean, this is all preliminary. It's still work very much in progress. I know what S ought to be. I know what a Clifford bundle ought to be because the Lie algebra of A is not so hard. It's polarized in a nice way. It has a nice polarization that you would need to define a Clifford module. So you could define a Clifford module on A. It's basically the Clifford module on the Lie algebra of this infinite dimensional Lie group G. But the problem, of course, is I don't know what that Dirac operator ought to be. One needs to actually go back and look at what their Dirac operator is and how much of that specifically relies on the affine case, on the loop group situation. Now, this is stuff that Greg has worked out, Greg Glanweber, and various other people. So I need to sort of go ahead and go through what their arguments are and see how much of that would generalize to the hyperbolic case to see if there is a Dirac operator and if this isomorphism is induced actually by a Thom isomorphism of this setting, that you have a Clifford bundle and you could twist it by integral representation to get an element in this K-theory. Okay, so I have two more minutes, and this is where I want to stop in regards to this, but what do I want to really say about why did I introduce Tietz buildings, topological Tietz building? So I think they're important for the following reason. When one wants to study infinite dimensional groups, so this goes back to Quillen, his idea. So would you want to study infinite dimensional groups via their actions on various things? It's hard to deal with it in that generality because your isotropy may be huge. You're working with an infinite dimensional group, and it's acting on things with huge isotropy. So what do? Well, you sort of free up that action. You take that action and you parametrize it over a space which is contractible in every sense that you'd possibly want, and the isotropy is now compact, and then analyze the space. Okay, so you do it after you parametrized it over this a contractible space with compact isotropy. So, for example, if you want to study the K-theory of your loop group or a Kac-Moody group, you don't want to study the K-theory of a point, and you'd be hard-pressed to actually define what it means, the loop group equivariant K-theory of a point. But then what you really want to do is you replace that point by exactly a Tietz building of this sort, which is really what a point is in the homotopy theoretic world. It's this classifying space of proper actions. It's the universal space that behaves nicely. It's contractible, right? Take the compact group being the trivial group. One of the conditions says it's contractible. For any compact group, the fixed-point sets are contractible. The isotropy groups are all compact. And so now you can start trying to define what K-theory is, and this construction of Fried-Hopkins-Telemann says, well, that's the right K-theory, and it gives you the right answer. It gives you the answer that you'd really want it to give you. So you want to look at K-theory of this object. Now, the other remark I want to make, which is something I really don't know much about, but it's just something curious that I've noticed. One would really want to define the K-homology of something like this, the K-homology of these spaces for the infinite dimensional groups. Now, in the locally compact setting, you can define K-homology of these EGs, classifying space of proper actions. And there's a conjecture out there called the Baum-Kahn's conjecture that relates this with the K-theory of a C-star algebra of continuous functions on this locally compact group. So, and there's a map that goes from the equivariant K-theory of homology of this space EG to assembly map, it's called the index map, that goes to the K-theory of the C-star algebra, and the claim is that that's an isomorphism. And it's been established for these NT-type groups. So it's actually a theorem of Kasparov that this map is an isomorphism of groups of the type NT. So what we've really established is if you were to define a K-theory, K-homology, it would sit naturally as a sumand in the K-theory of the C-star algebra as a locally supported function of continuous functions vanishing at infinity on this locally compact group N of T. And it'd be a natural sumand in there. And this map that goes from this equivariant K-homology into this is known as index map or assembly map. The reason it's called index map is something that I don't completely understand, but it goes back to the work of Kasparov. We actually gave a geometric description of this K-homology in terms of Dirac operators on certain manifolds. And the index naturally sat inside the K-theory of the C-star algebra. I mean, it's curiously resemblant of these constructions of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann, but I wish I knew more about something like that. So what I would really like to know is if there is somehow a K-homology, which may be completely obvious to various people, but not something that I know in enough detail to make sense of right now. So that's the other thing. And the last thing I want to mention is again, since it happens to be Jack's 60th year, Jack and I actually got some leverage out of this construction in the case of loop groups. You could, when you're trying to calculate the dual of the... So for a manifold, there's a concept that you can take the Spanier-Whitehead dual, thinking of the manifold as a topological space. You can talk of its Spanier-Whitehead dual. But then a theory of duality says, well, there's a very nice geometric description of it. It's the Thom space of suitably desuspended normal bundle of your manifold. It's the Thom spectrum. Now, you'd like to do something like that in the equivariant in the loop group setting. So you take the loops on a manifold and try to construct its Spanier-Whitehead dual or the Atiyah dual. But it's infinite dimensional, of course. You have the same problem. What do you mean by the Thom spectrum or the normal spectrum? The normal of the Thom, the negative of the Thom of the tangent bundle, Thom spectrum, the negative of the tangent bundle on an infinite dimensional manifold. What exactly do you mean by it? Well, you can work in the world of prospectra if you really wanted to. But the problem is it's not even a prospectra. But if you were to parametrize this tangent, this loop space over this Tietz building, then all of a sudden things become nice enough that you can construct Thom spectra, you could desuspend spectra. You can desuspend bundles. You can smash it with negative bundles to get actually a prospectrum that gives you the right notion of the Atiyah dual of the loop space of a manifold. So that for me was another indication that one needs to really parametrize over these Tietz buildings in the topological setting to get meaningful results in topology. So I'll stop over there. Thank you.